From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It was standard fare in the Republican stump speech of the 1980s. Now it's on a comeback tour in the last weeks of the presidential campaign. It is the L word, liberal. George Bush says John Kerry is too liberal to be president. Kerry says, let's move on. Tonight on Point, the liberal label and what punch it packs in campaign 2004. But first, we go to New York, where investigations are expanding into the business practices of at least five insurance industry giants. New York Attorney General Elliot Spitzer has accused Marcin McLennan, American International Group, and Ace Limited of fraudulent business practices, including bid rigging and improper payments to insurance brokers. For the latest on the investigation and its meaning for insurance policyholders, we turn to Carrie Coolidge, staff writer for Forbes magazine. Carrie, thanks for being with us.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I wish you could give us a simplified version of what's going on with this investigation. It's so deep in the insurance industry, you know, weeds that a lot of us have trouble following it. What's happening? What's being investigated here?
Well, basically what happened was a week ago today, Attorney General of New York, Elliot Spitzer, sued the nation's leading insurance brokerage firm, which is Marsh & McLennan, alleging that it steered unsuspecting clients to insurers with whom it had lucrative payoff agreements and that the firm solicited rigged bids for the insurance contracts.
So steering clients, but when you say clients of Marsh McLennan, are you talking about, Ma and Pa Kettle? Or are you talking about big business? Who are their clients?
No, these are commercial clients. These are big companies, Fortune 500 companies. I should say Forbes 500 companies, but you get the idea. It's not mom and pop, you know, it's not their auto insurance. At least that does not involve the Marsh McLennan.
And why is Elliot Spitzer upset about this? What's the wrongdoing that he's describing?
Well, basically, he thinks that these alleged wrongdoings, especially the rigged bids, means that companies may have been paying a lot more for insurance than they really should have.
This is being described as an enormous potential scandal, maybe bigger than the mutual fund scandal. Why is that? Are we having a corrupt industry described, or what's the picture?
Well, I think that there are two things going on right now. The important thing to recall is that Spitzer said this is just the tip of the iceberg,
mm-hmm.
and there are lots more lawsuits to come. And what he is part of what he's attacking with Marsh McLennan is something that's been industry practice, practiced for decades by a lot of insurance companies and brokerage firms, and those are the alleged kickbacks. That was just common industry practice. So changing industry practice means a big change in the industry.
So inside the industry, there are a lot of people saying Elliot Spitzer is just grandstanding again. He's got us over a barrel. We can't do anything about it. But as you say, this is longstanding practice. Elliot Spitzer is saying, no, this is wrong, and we've got to clean it up. Who's carrying the day?
Well, I think Elliot Spitzer, he's very pro-consumer. And what he doesn't believe is that companies should be collecting money from both the clients, the policyholders, as well as the insurance companies. And that's what happened in a lot of the other scandals that he broke. It's the problem at the root of it is a financial services organization collecting money on both ends.
So if I've got insurance as a homeowner or life insurance or auto insurance, is this likely to be affecting my premiums?
Well, that remains to be seen. If insurance companies feel that they will be losing a lot of money, I doubt it will really affect the individual policyholder. In fact, they may end up getting even a better deal, especially if they deal with a brokerage firm that is getting the alleged kickbacks. But at any point, the thing to remember is at this point, it really is just affecting the commercial insurers and commercial clients, and that perhaps other companies will be involved. Elliot Spitzer has issued subpoenas to companies like MetLife looking for information about their employee benefits practices. So it hasn't yet exactly affected the individual lines yet, such as auto and life insurance.
But he's really scouring the industry. It's had a big effect on some of their stock prices. Marsh & McLennan way down, 40% plus down. Are we likely to see some insurance companies fail as a result of this investigation?
You know, I really doubt it. I think what's going to happen is they'll end up being a major settlement. I really doubt that any insurance company would fail. The way that they're set up with the reserves and so forth, the regulators really try their very hardest to prevent insurance companies from failing, and I think that this is really going to affect the brokers more so than the insurance companies.
And on the other side of this investigation, what are you hearing from the insurance industry? Are we going to see a kind of cleaned up industry, which has got a tightened up ethics, a higher standard of ethics on the other side of this?
I think that's absolutely. I think that a lot of the big insurance companies came forward just in the past week, including American International Group and ACE, which are two companies named as in the Spitzer suit,
right,
not as defendants, but named as, you know, as being involved and with the alleged practices. They've come forward and said they're not going to pay these quote-unquote kickbacks anymore to the brokerage industry. So I think the industry is already trying to quickly clean up its act.
So a huge industry rocking on the basis of investigations this week and maybe coming out cleaner on the other side. Carrie Coolidge, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Carrie Coolidge is a staff writer for Forbes magazine. She spoke with us from New York. In the final stretch of the presidential campaign, the L word is back, and the president is pasting it all over John Kerry. The challenger is working hard to avoid being pinned, saying labels don't matter. But this one seems to sting a little. If it didn't, the Democrats might well be using it to describe themselves. Conservatives call themselves conservatives. Many liberals today call themselves almost anything else, progressives, pragmatists. Tonight, we'll look at why and what's behind the words. This hour, On Point, the liberal label and the 2004 election. Is liberal bashing a winning strategy for George Bush in 2004? What does liberal mean to you today? Are you drawn to it, repelled by it? Is the word liberal still the kiss of death in American politics? Was it ever? Is it coming back or still in exile? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Santa Cruz, California, is Jeffrey Nunberg, senior researcher at the Center for the Study of Language and Information at Stanford University and author of Going Nuclear, Language, Politics, and Culture in Confrontational Times. Jeff Nunberg, thanks for joining us tonight.
Oh, thanks very much for having me.
So you've been paying a lot of attention to this word and its history and evolution lately. How do you see where the word liberal stands today, Jeffrey Nunberg, and how did it get here?
Well, you know, as late as the 1960s, everybody wanted to be a liberal. There was a cartoon in the New York Times, I think, in 1961 that showed a whole group of politicians smearing liberal makeup on and liberal eyeshadow and
okay.
and other liberal marks on their face just so they'd look liberal. And it really was a badge of honor until. Probably until the Nixon years when Spiro Agnew started taking after it, and then in the 80s the Republicans began to take after it, in particular Reagan and George H.W. Bush. Reagan said, the masquerade is over. It's time to use the dreaded L word to say the policies of our opposition are liberal, liberal, liberal. And it was part, really, of a branding campaign that was aimed at branding liberals not simply as high-spending, high-taxing, tax-and-spend people, but also as effete Eastern consumers of foreign products like Chardonnay and Brie, to the point where really now when people talk about liberals, they have in mind, I think, less political philosophy than a lifestyle, a character type, something on that order.
And when Americans hear the word or when they think about themselves, what portion attach the label to themselves or think of themselves as liberal?
Well, in surveys in recent years, they're about anywhere from 16 to 20% of Americans will call themselves liberals. Anywhere from 30 to 35% call themselves conservatives, and the rest say they're in the middle of the road or they won't acknowledge the label. That I think is a little misleading because it has more to do with the label than the views. In those same surveys, when you ask people who's better set up to address to make the tax system fair, you'll get a majority saying, for instance, the Democrats rather than the Republicans. So a lot of the people who are diffident about wearing the liberal label actually have views that most people would describe as liberal.
And yet the way conservative and liberal are used today has become quite different, as you describe it. There are applications of the word liberal or conservative that just don't seem to work or be used much with liberal anymore. Can you give us an example?
Well, I'll give you one very striking example. When you look at the press, and by that I mean not just the general press, but the so-called liberal media, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, you find that in those newspapers, the word liberals almost never used in connection with a phrase like working class. You never see the phrase working class liberal. You never see black liberal. You never see Latino liberal. You only see middle class liberals. Where people, the reporters will talk about working class conservatives, black conservatives, and so on. And so even for reporters in those papers, there's an assumption that liberalism is something associated with a white middle-class lifestyle.
So as a linguist, what does that say to you about what's happened with this word, or what's been done to it, or how it's evolved?
Well, I think it's really been sort of negatively branded. It's acquired this association with a bunch of negative social characteristics that are pretty far from the political beliefs and philosophies that originally constituted liberalism and that still constitute liberalism for those who are willing to own up to the label.
So are you surprised to see it making a comeback in 2004 when President Bush really jumped on it in the third debate, describing John Kerry as this, you know, far on the far left bank and bringing out the liberal word? We heard him using it again today. There was some commentary after the third debate that this had a kind of a retro sound, like the sound of the politics of the 80s. But here it is, 2004. Are you surprised?
No, not really. I'm not surprised to hear a Republican bringing out the L word, particularly in the late stages of a campaign. What I think is interesting, I mean, two things have happened. In very recent polls, the number of Americans willing to describe themselves as liberals has actually gone up by quite a bit, by about 20%, which indicates that for a lot of people, I think it has something to do with this sort of Crips versus Bloods, the formats of these talk shows. Either you're a conservative or a liberal. You tune into Fox. You look at Bill O'Reilly or Sean Hannity. You say, boy, I think that guy's a jerk. I must be on the other side. I must be a liberal. Everybody's having to choose up sides. That's what polarization means. So to a certain extent, if you'd asked me 2 years ago, I would have said the L word was on its way out and it would be replaced, as you said at the top of the piece, with progressive, with pragmatist, with something else. Or people will say, as Dean did, well, if being a liberal means you're for a balanced budget, then I'm a liberal. They'll slide off it that way. My sense is that whether or not Kerry owns up to the label in this campaign, the label actually will survive and actually come back a bit over the next four years or so.
But you've been watching Democratic politicians and the ways in which they sidestep the word. John Kerry, not least of them, but others as well.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think there are a lot of younger people in particular who have no problem with the word, maybe because they don't remember all the problematic associations. They don't remember Reagan. They don't remember Bush's father. And a lot of them, it turns out, are actually happily describing themselves as liberals. A friend of mine was telling me, you know, he was on a dating site and all of the people were describing themselves either as liberals or conservatives. But people had no qualms about describing themselves as liberals, particularly of another generation.
Jeffrey Nunberg, you're looking at how words can be framed and shaped. In this case, you're saying the branding has kind of been done by the opposition to the liberal camp. But as a linguist, is a word vulnerable to that kind of redefinition or negative branding if there's no kernel of truth in the critique?
Well, I certainly think that this began at a moment in the late 70s when there was a crisis among liberals about issues by civil rights, which for a long time cost the Democratic Party the South. The liberalism was torn apart by the Vietnam War, with a lot of people on the left attacking the liberal label. Remember Phil Oakes singing "Love Me, I'm a Liberal." The Great Society programs looked at least as if they had failed. So there was a sense of liberalism not having delivered on its promises, and that certainly set up the stage for the attacks in the 1970s. But a lot of that, I think, grew out of these difficulties in the sense that the Republicans were trying to say, particularly to working class whites, you know, those guys are East Coast elitists. They as we'd say now, they do windsurfing. They eat brie. Never mind. I actually looked this up. It turns out that the majority of brie consumers in America are actually Republicans. But that's neither here nor there, because, look, this stuff is soft and pale and runny and French, right? What better product to stand in for the mentality and the consumer preferences that the right wanted to associate with liberals? So certainly liberalism had stumbled and stumbled very badly when this happened. But the branding campaign was, in a certain sense, over and above that.
Jeffrey Nunberg, it's always great talking with you. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks very much for having me on.
We're talking tonight about the liberal label and what punch it packs in campaign 2004. You can join the conversation tonight. Is liberal bashing a winning strategy for George Bush in 2004? Is it retro? Is it over with? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the liberal label and what punch it packs in campaign 2004. The punches were still being thrown today. President Bush was in where? Hershey, Pennsylvania. You heard it at the top of the hour, but let's listen again. He tried to tarnish John Kerry's standing as a liberal, making fun of photos that showed John Kerry out today hunting for geese. Here's the president.
Can you imagine being more liberal than Ted Kennedy? He can run. He can even run in camo, but he cannot hide.
Cannot hide from the liberal label, says President George Bush. John Kerry has responded to that general line of attack, saying that categories like liberal are meaningless. Let's hear that.
The president's just trying to scare everybody here with throwing labels around. I mean, compassionate conservative, what does that mean? Cutting 500,000 kids from after-school programs? Cutting 365,000 kids from health care? Running up the biggest deficits in American history? Mr. President, you're batting 0 for 2.
John Kerry saying, let's not get stuck on labels, let's look at issues. So here we are with the liberal label and the campaign 2004. This isn't Reagan years, this isn't Bush 1, this isn't even Clinton in 96. This is 2004, and it's back, and we're wondering what kind of punch it packs this year. You can join the conversation tonight. When George Bush calls John Kerry a left bank liberal, does that sound to you like cheap rhetoric or the heart of the matter, of some matter? And what does liberal mean to you today? Are you drawn to the word or repelled? Does it sound like a musty old 1980s zinger or still relevant, still cutting? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight in the studio by Robert Reich. He's professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University, former secretary of labor under the Clinton administration, author of Reason, Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. Robert Reich, thanks for being with us tonight.
Well, good to be here, Tom.
And from Washington joining us tonight, Stephen Moore, president of the Club for Growth, contributing editor of the National Review. He was a senior economist at the Joint Economic Committee under Chairman Dick Armey of Texas, author of Government, America's Number One Growth Industry, well-known conservative. Stephen Moore, thanks for joining us tonight.
Good evening, Tom.
Robert Reich, first to you. The liberal label is back in play in a pretty big way since that third debate in this campaign. Are you surprised? What do you think of its effectiveness this year?
Well, I think it can be pretty effective because there are two different criticisms that are tied up in that liberal label, Tom. As Jeffrey Nirenberg reminded us, it is an old criticism of the big government, tax and spend, wishy-washy, limousine liberals. But there's also a flavor of this new or newer criticism, a cultural criticism, that these are people who are out of touch with working America. They are East Coast, West Coast, ACLU, latte, sipping, breed. So that although it's a conversation stopper, it packs a little bit of a wallop. I should say, and again, I think Jeffrey Nirenberg pointed to this, this is not a new device by conservatives, by Republicans. In fact, by 1976, it was such a powerful, negative-sounding term that Mo Udall in that campaign said, I am not going to be called liberal any longer. It's just a terrible term. I want to call myself from now on a progressive. In fact, we heard and we began to hear in the late 1970s liberals calling themselves not liberals, but using that term from the first decades of the 20th century, progressives.
And is it working? I don't hear it much. I mean, it's out there. I hear liberals saying the same thing now. People sitting in Starbucks, sipping lattes, saying, don't call me a liberal, call me a progressive.
Well, I'll tell you, the Trump that many liberal politicians or people who feel that basically we're all together in some sort of an enterprise, owe something to each other, what they usually do when they're accused of being liberals, they say back. Now, John Kerry didn't, but what we've heard the past few years is, if being liberal means that you care about the little guy, that you care about protecting Social Security, unemployment insurance, you care about raising the minimum wage, you care about da-da-da-da-da-da-da, then I'm proud to be a liberal. But that ploy, rhetorically, has to contain a new definition rather than simply use the definition, the implied definition that the conservative wants to use, which is big government, tax and spend, wishy-washy, limousine liberal.
Stephen Moore, how about it? President Bush has raised it in a big way again, using it again today. When he put it to John Kerry in that third debate, John Kerry said, oh, come on, let's not get hung up on labels. What's a label here and what's a substantive face of this word liberal? Is this just labeling or something bigger?
Well, I almost fell off my chair because for the first time in my life, I agreed with everything Robert Reich said. I think he's exactly right that this became a dirty word in the late 1970s. That was sort of when I was baptized in American politics. And I remember some of those elections that Robert Reich was talking about when people like Mo Udall and Bai of Indiana and others, you know, lost in that election of 1980. And what happened in that election was that they were all labeled liberals. And that was a real black mark against them, and many of them lost. I think that that Robert Reich is quite correct that that label still packs a punch to it. And I think partly it's because fundamentally I think the country is pretty conservative, really, when it comes to social, cultural, and fiscal issues. Even Democrats now call themselves fiscal conservatives. And so I think that when you've got John Kerry saying that he doesn't want to be called a liberal and that these labels don't matter, I think he understands that it does pack a punch to it. And the problem for John Kerry is that what we've been saying about him, because we've been running, you know, various ads, is, you know, he's in the George McGovern, Walter Mondale, Michael Dukakis liberal vein. And that's something, you know, of course, all of those Democrats lost.
So the power in that punch and the hope that it will work again this year, do you think it's as powerful as it was in the 70s, in the 80s when Reagan was there, even when Bush Sr. was using it? Does it have a little bit of a passé feeling about it now or not?
We certainly don't think so. I mean, we've been running at the Club for Growth, the organization that I run. You know, we're involved in dozens of congressional and Senate races around the country, and also involved in the presidential race. And we love to call our Democrat opponents liberals, because in a lot of places, now it is true. One thing that we have to get into later in the program is I do think that this country is very regionally divided. So that, you know, to call somebody a liberal in Rhode Island isn't going to pack much of a punch, but to call them a liberal in South Carolina, that's really walloping them.
And Robert Reich, behind the word, there's this debate over what America actually is. Stephen Moore says it's a very conservative country if you look in on it.
Well, Stephen worried me. Steve, you worried me when you said that you and I really agreed, because but I was relieved then to hear you go on and say that America has grown much more conservative. That's really not the case. You look at polls today and you see that much of the New Deal legacy, Social Security, unemployment insurance, minimum wage, and then you go on to the 60s and 70s, most people support Medicare, environmental protection, workplace safety, Medicaid. After Roe v. Wade, most people in this country are in favor of reproductive rights, freedom of choice. Look at today's headlines. The flu vaccine. I mean, people are, their first impulse is, where was government? Where was the FDA? The insurance scandal. Why don't we have better regulation? The impulse in the country is not conservative. The impulse, though, is no longer the kind of liberalism that we saw in the 1960s, which was discredited even in the 1960s. You know, the right and the left got together in the 60s and basically squeezed and squelched liberalism. I remember the community organizer Saul Alinsky, a real lefty, saying a liberal is the kind of person that leaves the room when a fight begins. The kind of just somebody without principles. So the term...
Saying he as a lefty wanted to be right in that fight.
Absolutely. It's the term, the brand, like Studebaker or now perhaps Enron, it's just been discredited. But the actual underlying values are still very, very much there.
Stephen Moore, what do you make of that? You know, there's this debate about what America is really at bottom. And, of course, maybe it's both things at bottom. But Robert Reich says it's certainly not straightforward conservative at bottom. There's a lot of support for what it was traditionally, originally associated back all the way to FDR with liberal programs, values.
Well, there is a lot of truth to what Robert Reich just said. I would say that The country doesn't want to probably go as far to the left as liberals want to, though. For example, on health care, Robert Reich is exactly right that the country has embraced Medicare and Medicaid, but the country certainly doesn't want to embrace national health care. And in fact, Senator Kerry has really distanced himself from that idea, even though I think in his heart of hearts he probably would like to see a national health care thing. Let me just say that I think when we as conservatives, and I consider myself a conservative, talk about liberals, we have some sort of code words or code ideas that we're underlying, we're trying to get across to American voters. And I was thinking about things like abortion, guns, taxes, weak on defense. Those are some of the things, a big government. Those are the kinds of ideas that the conservatives, the reasons that we use that liberal term as a term of aspersion.
Robert Reich, how about that list? John Kerry is now quoted all over the place as having this very liberal voting record. President Bush talks about it all the time by a number of different counts. And I know you can say, well, in this year or that, he was on the campaign trail. That's why he wasn't there for that vote. That's how he turns out that way. But he's being described as George Bush as more liberal than Ted Kennedy. What does that mean in terms of the laundry list that Stephen Moore would like to explicitly like to pin on him with that label?
Well, I can tell you, I've just got back from most of the last 3 months in the battleground states, going around talking to people earning mostly between $15,000 and $40,000, your old working class, and they
near the median.
And they are basically concerned about jobs and wages and health care. That's what I hear over and over and over again, and they would like some solutions. Now, they don't want big government. Nobody likes big government. That's another branding problem. But when you ask them exactly what should happen with regard to jobs and wages and health care, they said, we want some help. We want, of course, we want to take responsibility. We are willing to take responsibility. We work very hard. Our spouses are working hard. But that's the core of America right now in terms of where people are concerned. Like, putting to one side, yeah, of course, Iraq and terrorism is a big, big deal. But if you talk about domestic issues, and that's the heart of the liberal conservative debate right now, it's really domestic. It's not, I mean, Kerry wants to, you know, has a different philosophy of how we go about fighting terrorism. But right now, it is about jobs, wages, and health care. The so-called social issues that Stephen Moore is talking about.
Gay
guns,
marriage, gay
abortion,
rights,
gay
guns,
marriage.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, undoubtedly, there's a big split in the nation. That's not new. Most people don't want gay marriage, although most Americans, by the polls, are in favor of civil sort of unions. They want to provide equal protection under the laws. Most people under 30, interestingly, kind of a significance of where we're going as a country, are actually in favor of gay marriage. Most people, as I said before, the polls are very, very clear about this, Steve. Most people are in favor of reproductive rights, freedom of choice. It is still a divisive issue in this country, but Americans come down squarely, a majority come down squarely in favor of that should be between a woman and her partner and her doctor.
Robert Reich, Stephen Moore, I want to begin to turn to our callers. We're talking tonight about the liberal label and what punch it packs in campaign 2004. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Dave is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm one of the people that considered myself conservative, and I voted for Reagan twice. And I've become very discouraged with conservative. And the conservative label, that's an immediate turnoff anymore. The things that started to turn me were watching. I was conservative, I thought, because I was fiscally conservative, and
right.
I thought we ought to have a strong defense. But I watched over time as Reagan did things such as he didn't want to permit fetal tissue transplants, and Bush did the same thing. And this happened after my father was diagnosed with Parkinson's. And then I began to see the real effect of some social programs and how helpful they were, such as Medicare, when he really did get sick with the effects of Parkinson's.
So when someone asks you today, Dave, are you a liberal, how do you respond?
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have any problem with that. And I think more people who are in my age group who see, for instance, the programs that help take care of their parents may start to change or not feel bad about that label.
Dave, how old are you, if I may ask?
49.
49, and you're not uncomfortable with it. Dave, thanks for calling. Stephen, what do you hear in this caller's observation?
Well, I think that most Americans who are of that age group, if you ask them, do you want higher taxes, they're going to say no. Do you want a lot more big government, they're probably going to say no. When you ask them, what do you think about issues like gay marriage, most of them are going to say no. So I do think that this sort of great middle class that is the what we're all going for in terms of the voting bloc right now in this election, I would go back to what I said at the outset. I think that fundamentally on these kind of key issues, they think of themselves as moderate to conservative, not liberal.
Robert Reich.
If I could just – in fact, it's interesting. Dave from Erie, Pennsylvania. I was out in Erie, Pennsylvania just this morning talking to a fairly cross-section. I was trying to find independents and people who were still not made up – had not made up their mind in this election. Mm. But we got into conversations, and I've had the same conversation with people about deficit spending. It turns out, as you know undoubtedly, people who are listening, that this administration has the largest deficit we've had in history, not as a proportion of national product, but still huge, as did the Reagan and first Bush administrations. It was my administration, the Clinton administration, that brought the deficit down. The parties and the ideologies are sort of all scrambled over the deficit. Stephen, you talk about taxes. Well, that big tax cut, mostly for wealthy people on the income tax side and on some of the other investment sides, actually ended up, if you look at payroll taxes and property taxes and sales taxes and all of the other taxes that had to go up to compensate for the losses of revenues in other areas, most middle-class and working-class people are spending more, paying more in taxes than they used to pay. And then, Stephen, one final point, and I hear this over and over again, the term big government, if you talk about what the current administration is doing in terms of military procurement and also intrusions on civil liberties and what I have always called, unfortunately, it's a terrible term, but it is part of our fact of life today, and that is corporate welfare. Look at that new corporate tax bill, Steve, that just went through the Congress.
$160 billion, or something like that.
This is the biggest government we've ever had. The question is not the size of the government. The question is, whose side is government on? Who does it represent? Who does it care about? Who does it work for? And that's the real division between liberals and conservatives today, it seems to me.
Stephen Moore, but the phrase conservative doesn't seem, among a lot of people, to yet dump that entire load of complaints on the Republican Party, as liberal still seems
right
to leave a problem for the Democrats.
I think that's a big problem for the case that Robert Reich is trying to make. I mean, the truth is, you know, I run in conservative circles, and there aren't a lot of conservatives who, you know, shriek at the idea of being called a conservative. But on the liberal side, you know, in a lot of these congressional races, you know, these congressional candidates, the Democrats say, I'm not a liberal, I'm a progressive, or I'm a moderate or a centrist. And so it does seem as though they're running away from the label. We were the group, incidentally, when you were talking about, you know, sushi eating and issues like that. We ran this ad, you may recall, back in Iowa against Howard Dean that was very devastating, where it just showed a couple of Iowa farmers walking out of a barber shop. And it just said, what do you think about Howard Dean's idea of raising taxes on you? And you know, we just had all these liberal labels. Like, and the farmer said, well, I think that Howard Dean should take his sushi-eating, Volvo-driving, big government-loving, high-tax, you know, policies back to Vermont. And they were actually quite devastating, even in a Democratic primary.
So it worked, and yet there's something that feels a little behind the curve about it. We're looking at that tonight. The liberal label, the punch it packs this year. Campaign 2004. Robert Reich is with us, and Stephen Moore, you can join us as well. Why do conservatives embrace their label and liberals still seem to duck theirs? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the liberal label in the 2004 campaign. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight in the studio with me, Robert Reich. He was Secretary of Labor under Bill Clinton. He's author of Reason Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. And with us from Washington, Stephen Moore, president of the Conservative Club for Growth, author of Government, America's Number One Growth Industry. Brandon is calling from Harwich, Massachusetts. Hi, Brandon. You're on the air.
Hi. Some of the things that I was actually calling about have already been addressed. But I know for myself, the definitions, I think these days, you know, in a more modern sense of conservative and liberal, I mean, they're so muddy, you know, which Mr. Reich was just saying about, you know, how this administration has spent so much money and there's so much debt. And we have one of the biggest governments ever, which is, of course, the diatribe used against liberals. And I know for myself, I don't at all identify with this administration, but you can't use liberal as a counter definition either these days, because you have no credibility thanks to, you know, the Sean Hannitys of the world. So what do you do? I mean, like, I'm 24, you know, for someone looking for a sort of identity, you can't really use progressive or even, I remember recently I used as a joke, oh, I'm libertarian. And this girl who's my age is like, oh, so you're a liberal. You're just hiding. Right? Yes.
I don't know. Yeah. The spelling begins the same, but beyond that, I don't know how those connect. But it's a great question, Brandon. Let me put it to Robert Reich. I mean, here's a young guy looking out on the spectrum of politics, not comfortable with the current administration, doesn't see that alternative kind of pole to rally round. A, what's your advice to him, Robert Reich? B, is it a problem for the Democratic Party that they don't have that word, that idea that can be summed up in a single word that stands at the middle of the sort of party campgrounds, as the Republicans still do have conservative in the middle of theirs?
Well, I don't think it's a huge problem because more and more of the people I talk with around the country are like Brandon. I mean, they say, look at these terms are so muddy. They are meaningless. I want to talk about issues. I want to have a real discussion. I just don't want people to just have conversation stoppers by calling, you know, you're a liberal, or, by the way, the way liberals characterize conservatives is right-winger. Now, nobody wants to be a right-winger. That's the moral equivalent of being a liberal. You know, we can debate until we're all bleary-eyed what the proper word should be. Brandon, I am very proud to call myself a liberal, always have been, but progressive is something that a lot of people who are in their 20s and 30s do now embrace, and maybe a new word will come along, maybe you'll invent one. But if you care about, taking our democracy back, if you care about making sure that our fiscal house is in order and that people have can afford health care and that we have a moral responsibility to one another and also the rule of law in the world, call yourself a tangerine. I don't care.
But doesn't it matter, Robert Reich, as a matter of political expediency, political effectiveness, words are important. Doesn't it matter that there's this kind of language vacuum that we're dancing around here tonight, that you see Democratic politicians dancing around all the time, at the center of that pile of issues and ideas and values, which are very real, but isn't it important to have some kind of, you know, congealing word?
It's always nice to have a brand. No matter what you're trying to sell, it's great to have a brand. But it's hard to sustain a brand in politics. I mean, look at George Bush, couldn't use conservative, he had to use compassionate conservative, because conservative wasn't good enough.
Mm-hmm. Too close to right wing.
And then when you talk about compassionate service, then that starts breaking down because people just say, well, what do you mean compassionate conservative? Al Gore in the year 2000 was a pragmatic, what was that, a pragmatic liberal, or we can't even remember exactly what that word was.
Yeah.
But it's hard to come up with these broad, all-encompassing brands in politics. I don't get too exercised about, I would love the word liberal to be revived, and I've done a lot that I can, all I can do to try to revive it. But I'm much more concerned about the underlying issues.
Stephen Moore, what about Brandon's comment? He says even your word is getting a bit muddied. You've got conservative, but yet you've got huge deficits. You've got conservative, but you've also now got neoconservative, and you've got your own sort of civil wars within the conservative, very broad camp. Do you have some brand muddying going on?
Well, Brandon is exactly right that, in fact, if George Bush loses this election, I don't think he will, but if he does, I think one of the reasons he will lose is because he has been a big spender. He's been a liberal on spending. And in fact, to some extent, John Kerry has been able to get to the right of George Bush on this issue of the budget deficit that Robert Reich was just talking about. But the Democrats do have a problem in this election in that they have nominated someone who is on the left end of the party. I mean, there's no running away from John Kerry's record for the 20 years that he's been in the Senate. He has a very left-wing record. I mean, after all, he's a Democrat from Massachusetts. And that's a problem for the Democrats in this election, because even on an issue like abortion, where, you know, if you put a room of 30 people together, you're probably going to find 15 that call themselves pro-life and 15 who call themselves pro-choice. But John Kerry is against even things that almost everyone is for. For example, almost everybody is for getting rid of partial birth abortion. Well, John Kerry isn't. Or John Kerry is not in favor of parental notification for abortion. Most Americans are. And that's what I mean, that he's sort of so far to the left that it's easy to label him as a liberal.
I was just very interesting linguistically, Stephen, when you just shifted from liberal to left wing.
And I use those almost simultaneously. Well,
I think there's a subtle linguistic, very important shift there.
Okay.
Because, you see, I could say that George Bush has been the most right-wing president I remember, and I could give you the environment, and I could talk about unilateral decisions to go in and take over Iraq. I could talk about a whole variety of civil liberties. I mean, there's almost no end of things that we could... But what I want to suggest to you is that if we got under the labels and actually had a discussion about these things, it might be more illuminating.
Let me ask you on that point, Robert Reichson, about this characterization of John Kerry, because he's also got, you know, backing anti-crime measures, backing welfare reform, backing free trade. Do you see John Kerry as the definition of the left-wing liberal?
No, of course not. I'm not even sure, again, because we've been discussing what these terms mean, and they're very slippery.
Mm-hmm.
But John Kerry, Steve, if I could just go on.
Yeah.
I mean, on these kinds of issues, when I was in Washington working with Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton took positions that John Kerry agreed with on getting the deficit under control, on being very, very strong on defense, on getting rid of welfare. I personally didn't think that was the right decision, but Bill Clinton did and John Kerry did. I mean, we could go through a lot of issues in which the Democrats have actually taken positions that, and John Kerry took and has taken positions that are considered to be not only moderate, but even slightly right of center.
Let me get another caller here.
I have to disagree with that, though, because, I mean, if you look at his record, I mean, he is not I was sorry to interrupt, but I can't think of a single person in the United States Congress who is to the left of John Kerry on these issues. We haven't talked about national defense, but John Kerry for 20 years has voted virtually against every weapon system.
Steve, that's just simply untrue. I mean, let's not make this show another rehash of the debates we've been having during this election, but that's just factually untrue.
I want to get callers in here. Mike is calling from Greensboro, North Carolina. Mike, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm probably going to give you my view from the southeastern portion of the United States.
Let's have it.
Anyways, at one time, I think liberals championed all the social issues, and that was really important. But I think Ronald Reagan did a great job of saying to liberals, or putting a moniker on liberals, they're tax and spend liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was very true to a lot of people. Hey, I get a paycheck every week, and there's taxes coming out of it. So, you know, he's taxing and spending my money. So I think he did a good job at that. I think it still holds a little true in the Southeast when you say he's a tax and spend liberal, or he's a liberal. People still think about, hey, he's taking my paycheck and giving it to someone else.
And, Mike, when George Bush calls John Kerry a liberal in the debates now, do you think that that's simply that alone is turning people off? Or, as Robert Reich is suggesting, are people now in the mood to look behind or underneath the label, as John Kerry hopes they will?
I think in the Southeast it still does a little bit. I don't know about other parts of the country. But the best thing I ever heard about being a liberal conservative comes from Winston Churchill, and I'm paraphrasing. Mm-hmm. And he said that Winston Churchill said, when you're 20, if you're not a liberal, you have no heart. And when you're 40, if you're not a conservative, you have no brain.
I thought
that was the greatest thing I've ever heard about conservative.
We know who has the brains. You know, there used to be people in this country, Mike, called liberal Republicans. We haven't talked much about them. They're a rare species. There was a sighting recently of one dashing through an airport. But I remember when I came to Washington for the first time, there were a lot of people who called themselves liberal Republicans, Rockefeller Republicans. They were very proud of their tradition. Whatever happened to them?
Steve Moore?
Well, I think the parties have become much more identified and polarized ideologically. I don't happen to think that's necessarily a bad thing. I mean, now the Republican Party is, as Goldwater once said, a choice, not an echo. And for those years when the Republicans were Rockefeller Republicans, they basically would say, we want to spend as much money as we want the programs Democrats do. We just want to spend a little less. And we conservatives said that's not a very good winning formula. The one thing that we have going for us as conservatives against John Kerry is that he's from Massachusetts. And most people around the country think of people from Massachusetts as being pretty liberal.
And what about the New Deal? What do you think people think about the New Deal at this point, Stephen Moore? Are you ready to turn it back to get rid of all that? Do you think Americans are?
Well, I certainly am. But I think that most Americans have adopted these programs like Medicare and Social Security and even many of the Great Society programs, although we did turn back many of – I mean the welfare reform legislation we passed in the late 1990s was a landmark piece of legislation that did turn back some of the – excesses of the liberal welfare state.
Well, you know, as a proud resident of Massachusetts, I've got to take exception, Steve. When the Red Sox win the World Series, you're going to eat your hat.
I knew you would bring that up.
We can't help it. We can't help it tonight. It's in the air. Robert Reich, Stephen Moore, it's been a wonderful hour. Stephen Moore in Washington at the Club for Growth, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Thanks
a
lot.
And Robert Reich, great having you. Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor under the Clinton administration, author of Reason Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. In a moment, one new mother on the challenges of raising the next generation of Red Sox fans. This is On Point. After nearly a century of playing second fiddle to their New York rivals, the Boston Red Sox defeated the Yankees last night to win the American League pennant and advance to the World Series. For Red Sox fans, the victory was a big step toward breaking the dreaded curse of the Bambino, which is blamed for the Sox' 86-year championship drought. On Point producer Julie Jopp was one of thousands of New Englanders who celebrated last night's Red Sox victory, maybe a different tone in New York. But in this radio diary, she says she remains nervous about exposing her daughter to the team that has perennially disappointed its backers.
Last year, after Game 7 of the Yankees-Red Sox playoff, a friend told me that the worst thing her parents had done was to raise her to be a Red Sox fan. She suffered season after nail-biting season. And in her early 20s, she expected many years of disappointment to come. I spoke to her father. When you have children, he said, do not make the same mistake. Do not let them become Red Sox fans. His wife nodded in agreement. They tried, she said, to be good parents. They never realized how hurtful each Red Sox loss would be for their daughter. My husband and I now have a daughter of our own. We just celebrated Sophie's 3-month birthday. We, too, are trying to be good parents. We play her classical music, sing lullabies, and make her practice crawling, even though she hates being on her stomach. We agreed not to raise Sophie to be a Red Sox fan, so we resisted buying her the pink Red Sox onesies that are for sale on every other block in Boston. I kept her away from the television this week. And when I did join my husband to watch the playoffs, I made Sophie face the wall behind me. A colleague at work says supporting a team that perennially disappoints builds character. I'm not so sure. I grew up in New York, rooting for the Yankees. I liked it that my home team won, over and over again. By the end of Game 3 last week, I was feeling pretty smug about my decision not to expose my daughter to the Red Sox. Even Wednesday, I thought, there's no way the Red Sox beat the Yankees for a fourth straight game. Not only are they cursed, they're playing in New York. So Sophie and I missed Game 7. We missed Derek Lowe's pitching and Johnny Damon's 2 homers. And we missed what may have been the lifting of the 86-year-old curse of the Bambino. So I am left to wonder, if the curse is lifted, does that mean it's okay for my Bambino to join the Red Sox Nation? Sophie is too young to understand what it means to be a Red Sox fan. She's just getting the hang of sucking her thumb. And I'm not yet sure that the curse is really lifted. I'm a protective mother. I'm going to wait out the World Series. Then we'll see.
Julie Jopp is a producer with On Point. She lives in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.